U.S. President Joe Biden weighs in on pro-Palestinian protests.
We are not an authoritarian nation where we silence people or squash dissent.
U.S. to China and Russia. Let's agree not to let AI launch nuclear weapons on its own.
Wanting to keep a human in the loop when it comes to making decisions is especially, we're thinking about something as such as a first strike in a nuclear conflict.
And on this Press Freedom Day, we'll take a look at Russian independent journalists working in exile.
We are an undesirable organization, which means for the people who talk with us, it's a real danger.
Today is Friday, May 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Police have arrested more than 2,000 people during pro-Palestinian protests at college campuses across the United States, according to the Associated Press. U.S. President Joe Biden warned that order must prevail, even as he underscored that dissent is essential for democracy. The protests have become a growing political dilemma for Biden as Republicans accuse him of turning a blind eye to lawlessness and anti-Semitism, while young voters and progressive Democrats are incensed at the police crackdown. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wadakaswara takes a look at all of this for us in this report.
Police forcibly removed pro-Palestinian demonstrators Thursday, breaking up their encampment at the University of California, Los Angeles. It's the latest crackdown after weeks of escalating protests on campuses across the country. President Joe Biden finally addressed the issue Thursday, saying Americans have a right to protest, but not the right to cause chaos.
Peaceful protest is in the best tradition of how Americans respond to consequential issues. But, neither are we a lawless country. We are a civil society, and order must prevail.
Biden denounced Republican efforts to use the chaos as campaign fodder.
In moments like this, there are always those who rush in to score political points. But this isn't a moment for politics. It's a moment for clarity.
Republican lawmakers have accused Biden of turning a blind eye to lawlessness and anti-Semitism. Republican Senator Tom Cotton.
When will the president himself, not his mouthpieces, condemn these hate-filled little Gazas? President Biden needs to denounce Hamas's campus sympathizers without equivocating about Israelis fighting a righteous war of survival.
The protests are a growing political dilemma for Biden ahead of the November presidential election. While Republicans accuse him of coddling the demonstrators, young voters, progressive Democrats, Arab and Muslim Americans are incensed at police crackdowns on protests and Biden's steadfast support for Israel. Larry Sabato, director of the Center for Politics at University of Virginia, via Skype.
This issue is not going to resolve itself quickly, but it's possible with a ceasefire that other issues can come to the fore. Question is, will there be a ceasefire? Or are we going to continue with this level of warfare in Gaza and Israel all the way through the election? If so, I would say that it's going to prove very costly to President Biden.
Donald Trump, the former president and Republican presidential nominee, has criticized Biden's approach and supports the police crackdowns, like the one at Columbia University.
The police came in exactly 2 hours. Everything was over. It was a beautiful thing to watch. New York's finest.
More than 1,800 people have been arrested on college and university campuses since April 18th. Patsy Wadakaswara, VOA News, Washington.
Israeli settlers attacked two humanitarian aid convoys as they made their way toward the Gaza Strip, according to Jordan. U.S. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller says Israel should prevent further attacks on aid convoys.
These attacks on aid shipments are unacceptable, and that Israel ought to take steps to prevent them, and it ought to take steps to hold people accountable for them.
He also called Hamas's actions to divert aid to themselves unacceptable.
It was an unacceptable act by Hamas to divert this aid to begin with, to seize this aid. We have made clear that it's an unacceptable act. I think the UN partners will be also making clear that it's an unacceptable act. If there is one thing that Hamas could do to jeopardize the shipment of aid, it would be diverting it for their own use.
Both convoys eventually managed to make it to their final destination. Using AI, artificial intelligence, to launch a nuclear attack without a human in the loop shouldn't be allowed. The U.S. on Thursday urged China and Russia to match declarations by the United States and others that only humans and never artificial intelligence would make decisions on deploying nuclear weapons. Joining us now to talk about this is Lance Hunter, a professor at Augusta University and author of The Military Application of Artificial Intelligence Technology in the United States, China, and Russia, and the Implications for Global Security. So I got to be honest, when I saw the story today, the very first thing that popped into my head was the movie War Games with Matthew Broderick, you know, where he taps into the computer that runs the nuclear missiles for the United States, and he starts playing a game with it, and it wants to launch the missiles on its own. And then when I mentioned the story to someone else, the second thing that, you know, they thought of was Skynet, you know, and I'm like, oh yeah, of course, the machines take over. But it's not really far from those movies, right? Those scenarios.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. In that when we're thinking about autonomous weapon systems, especially lethal autonomous weapon systems, some people refer to as LAWs, you know, the one concern there is that if the weapon systems are making decisions themselves regarding, you know, initiating offensive maneuvers, a lot of times as we think about, such as, you know, launching a missile or thinking about some instances as drastic as a nuclear weapon, then that's going to be a very large concern. Because a lot of AI experts talk about the advantages that AI systems provide military, such as, you know, data collection, data analysis, helping in decision-making processes. But one of the things that's very important, and a term that's used a lot, is wanting to keep a human in the loop when it comes to making decisions, is especially we're thinking about such as a first strike in a nuclear conflict. And so if a human, a decision maker, is being taken out of that process to a larger degree, and the decision is being made by artificial intelligence, and it's an automated system where some type of factor, you know, triggers the system to make a decision to launch a missile or a strike, then that is very much a concern.
Now, you in your paper, you talk about the United States and China and Russia, exactly what we're talking about in this overture the U.S. made to China and Russia. How likely is it that they come on board on this?
That's a really good question. I would say we're thinking of China and Russia as far as coming on board, as far as the statement or agreement that artificial intelligence would not be part of their nuclear weapon systems, that's very unlikely, because they want artificial intelligence involved in their offensive weapon systems, especially when it comes to nuclear weapons. But when it comes to actually the decision to use a nuclear weapon as far as the first strike capability, I think you could possibly see them agree to that. Now, how that would actually play out if there was a potential conflict, I think could be very different, because it'd be one thing for them to publicly agree to that. It's another for that to be binding if a potential conflict were to arise. So they may agree that humans will still be involved in making decisions regarding the use of nuclear weapons, but AI will certainly be a part of their nuclear weapon systems. But you could see a public, you know, agreement to that, a human involved in overseeing the use of nuclear weapons. But actually how that would play out in actual conflict, I think that would remain to be seen.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? At some point in time, I was watching a discussion about this, not about using AI to autonomously launch nuclear weapons. But let's say the discussion was about, you know, theoretically teaching fighter jets how to fly themselves, using artificial intelligence to fly fighters. And the point was made that were you able to do that and reach that proficiency, you put the autonomous fighter up against a Top Gun graduate, the autonomous fighter's going to win because the computer can just think faster than a human. At some point in time, somebody's going to say, this gives us an advantage. Let's do it.
Right.
And then
right.
Everybody's going to have to do it.
Right, exactly. It's going to be very tempting for more militaries to use artificial intelligence in that capacity because of the advantages it provides them for speed, because speed is such a huge part of military conflict, and especially as AI programs become more powerful and sophisticated, it's going to be more tempting. And so if an adversary is using that and they have an advantage, then other states are going to want to follow suit. So absolutely.
Hmm. Something we'll have to keep an eye on. Hopefully we'll be able to chat about this in the future as it develops.
Right, absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming on and talking about it.
Okay, yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Professor Lance Hunter at Augusta University. We're following these other stories from around the world. South Korea's National Assembly voted on Thursday to approve a bill backed by the ruling and opposition parties to launch a fresh probe into the deadly Halloween crowd crush in the capital, Seoul, in 2022. 160 people were killed in that incident. Brazil declared itself free of foot and mouth disease without vaccination and will now request World Organization for Animal Health to recognize that status as it seeks to open more markets for its meat exports. Thousands of people protested in Slovakia on Thursday against a proposed overhaul by the government of public broadcaster RTVS, which it has accused of bias. The legislation is the latest step in what critics say is an effort by the prime minister to tighten control over the country. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, presumed Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump says if elected, he would restore a travel ban on some majority Muslim countries on the first day of his new administration. The travel ban was a controversial part of his first term as president and was rescinded by President Joe Biden. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns has our story.
When Donald Trump ran for president in 2016, he pledged to change U.S. immigration to keep out terrorists from Islamic countries.
And we will keep radical Islamic terrorists the hell out of our country, 100%. We have no choice. We have no choice.
Muslims are welcome! Are welcome!
Once in office, Trump banned travel to the U.S. from seven majority Muslim countries, sparking protests and legal challenges, including from the American Civil Liberties Union. Attorney Lee Gellernt.
If there are real threats, then those threats should be investigated on an individual basis. But we shouldn't assume that any group or religion is more dangerous than another group.
The travel ban was argued all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, where a conservative majority upheld it, in a move celebrated by Trump online and at the White House.
We have to be tough and we have to be safe and we have to be secure.
Joe Biden campaigned against the Trump travel ban in 2020.
You know, you don't have to accept the president who promulgates hatred and exclusion toward Muslims and trumped up bans on travel bans on Muslims.
And ended that ban when he became president. Now, 4 years later, Trump told supporters in Wisconsin this week that events in the Middle East convince him that it's time for another travel ban.
We do not need a jihad in the United States of America. We do not need our once great cities to become hotbeds of terrorism. And on day one of the Trump presidency, I'm restoring the travel ban, suspending refugee admissions, and keeping terrorists the hell out of our country. Like I had it before.
In this campaign, Biden has championed immigrant contributions to the United States, telling a group of campaign donors this week that other countries have suffered because they're xenophobic. immigrants are what makes us strong, Biden said, because, quote, we have an influx of workers who want to be here and want to contribute. An April Harvard Caps Harris poll shows immigration tied with inflation as the top issues for U.S. voters. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Solomon Islands lawmakers selected Jeremiah Manalay as their new prime minister on Thursday, elevating the former foreign minister, who has pledged to continue the Pacific Island nation's international policy that drew it closer to China. Reuters correspondent Diane Tao has this report.
I humbly stand before you.
Speaking outside Parliament, Manalay pledged to unveil new policies soon as the economy slowly recovers from the COVID-19 pandemic and 2021 anti-government riots.
The recent report by the central bank on the state of our economy is concerning.
Manalay was foreign minister and had traveled to China in 2019 to formalize the Solomon switch in diplomatic ties from Taiwan to Beijing. On Monday, Manalay said he would keep the same foreign policy basis, friends to all and enemies to none. His elevation to the top job comes after weeks of fierce competition with opposition parties to win support from independents. Last month's national election saw Manalay's party, under incumbent Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare, lose half of its parliamentary seats, but also delivered no majority to any party. The election has been closely watched by China, the United States and neighbouring Australia because of the potential impact on regional security. Sogavare had struck a controversial security pact with Beijing in 2022, which involved inviting Chinese police into Solomon Islands. The opposition coalition has been critical of the pact and favoured a return to closer ties with countries like Australia and the US. On Thursday, Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said on social media he looked forward to working closely with Manalay, saying their two countries were close friends with connected futures. While the Solomon's Chinese embassy said in a Facebook post it looked forward to working with him, quote, to develop China-Solomon Islands relations and deliver more benefits to our peoples.
Reuters correspondent Diane Tao. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Russian military personnel have entered the airbase in Niger that is hosting U.S. troops, according to a senior U.S. defense official who told that to Reuters. It's a move that follows a decision by Niger's junta to expel U.S. forces from the country. Russia has been quietly shipping refined petroleum to North Korea at levels that appear to violate a cap imposed by the United Nations Security Council. The White House said on Thursday that new sanctions could result. The disclosure came on the first day after a UN panel of experts monitoring enforcement of long-standing UN sanctions against North Korea for its nuclear weapons and missile programs was disbanded after a Russian veto. And finally, today is Press Freedom Day around the world. One place where there is no press freedom is Russia. Moscow has cracked down on Russian media outlets that offer independent reporting on the war in Ukraine, prompting hundreds of journalists to flee. But while in exile, these media workers have found ways to keep the news flowing into the heavily censored country. For VOA News, Lisa Bryant has the story from Paris.
Arnold Khachaturov got into journalism to provide his fellow Russians with a kind of news not seen on state-controlled channels. Then Russia invaded Ukraine and imposed new media restrictions that upended the Moscow-based reporter's career.
Every independent media in Russia was thinking how to continue, and because they were all blocked in a few days after the war started.
Khachaturov is one of more than 1,500 Russian journalists estimated to be living in exile. This year, his news outlet, Novaya Gazeta Europe, opened a third European office in Paris. Khachaturov covers European and Russian news for audiences inside and outside his home country, including the latest on the war in Ukraine. Inside Russia, the topic is heavily censored. Social media is crucial to his work.
It's indeed very hard to get information from Russia. Not only because we're not physically there, but also because we are an undesirable organization, which means for the people who talk with us, it's a real danger.
Jean Cavalier is the head of the Eastern Europe and Central Asia desk at the media watchdog Reporters Without Borders.
It always has been difficult for journalists, independent journalists in Russia, but the situation is getting worse since the war in Ukraine, with the whole military censorship. You can be put in prison for anything.
To help exiled Russian independent journalists broadcast their reports, Reporters Without Borders launched Svoboda, a satellite package that includes Novaya Gazeta Europe and other news channels. Supported by the European Union, it aims to reach several million households in Russia.
The television can be a powerful tool for Russian people to change their mind about the war, at least to have the facts, real facts, instead of propaganda.
Russian journalist and analyst Galia Ackerman says it was even more difficult accessing independent news in Soviet times. Living in Moscow decades ago, she and her husband listened to foreign radio late at night when there was less jamming.
My parents never came to listen with us. They didn't care, because for them it was simpler not to know.
That's one reason she's skeptical that the new satellite operation will make much of a difference inside Russia. Khachaturov is optimistic that democracy and free expression will one day come to Russia. But first, he says, he and other exiled journalists need to prepare for a long struggle. Lisa Bryant, VOA News, Paris.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. You can also get our app from Apple and Google. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States' long-standing One China policy, which is guided by the Taiwan Relations Act, the three joint communiques, and the six assurances, has promoted peace and prosperity in the region for 45 years, said Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs Daniel Crittenbrink in recent congressional testimony. The U.S. unofficial relationship with Taiwan, we are confident, is stronger than ever, said Assistant Secretary Crittenbrink. The 1979 Taiwan Relations Act, or TRA, has given us the tools that we need to pursue our overall objective of maintaining peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait.
Nearly a half century ago, it laid down a marker that the United States would consider any effort to determine the future of Taiwan by other than peaceful means a matter of grave concern. The TRA laid the foundation for the United States to provide Taiwan with the defense articles and services necessary to maintain a sufficient self-defense capability, as well as to maintain our own capacity to resist any resort to force or other forms of coercion against Taiwan.
The TRA also astutely anticipated the need to strengthen support for Taiwan, commensurate with the threat that it faces, explained Assistant Secretary Crittenbrink.
Indeed, in the 45 years since the passage of the Taiwan Relations Act, the PRC threat to Taiwan has indeed increased, and the PRC has never renounced the use of force to unify with Taiwan. In response to this threat, and consistent with our One China policy, this administration is bolstering cross-strait deterrence using the full range of tools at our disposal.
The United States' partnership with Taiwan has grown dramatically over the years, said Assistant Secretary Crittenbrink.
Taiwan is the United States' eighth largest trading partner, with bilateral trade in goods totaling nearly $128 billion in 2023, up from just $9 billion in 1979. TSMC's historic $65 billion investment in Arizona is the largest greenfield direct investment project in U.S. history, supported with up to $6.6 billion in direct funding through the CHIPS Act.
With the Taiwan Relations Act as a foundational element of our One China policy, said Assistant Secretary Critton Brink, we have deepened and expanded our ties with Taiwan over decades to reflect not only the threat Taiwan faces from the PRC, but also the vibrant partnership between the United States and Taiwan.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.